And continuing today with our theme of women in the arts, I'd like to welcome Ellen Berkovich. She's publisher and editor-in-chief of AdobeAirstream.com, and Marnie Sandweiss, professor of history at Princeton University. They're moderating an event called How to Be a Successful Woman Artist. It's on Wednesday, the 5th of August at 7 in the evening at the Munoz Waxman Gallery at the CCA here in Santa Fe, sponsored by the Women's International Study Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Great to have you both here. Now, continuing with the whole question of gender equity, which we were talking about a few moments ago with Susan Fisher Sterling, what does that look like in Santa Fe? I guess, Ellen, you've been collecting some statistics on this.
Well, there's been a national report card made by an artist collective called Pussy Galore in New York, and so I started to just compile, without being exhaustive about it, a Santa Fe report card of looking at the Railyard Arts District galleries, and looking at those galleries and the representation of women shows that most are far below 50% in their representation of women. The numbers look things like 21% women artists showing at Lou Allen, 26% at James Kelly, 25% at David Richard. It gets to a high at around 46% at William Siegel and
Go William
Santa
Siegel.
Fe. Go yeah. William Siegel. And Site Santa Fe, counting only, I should say, counting only solo exhibits for contemporary artists, not biennials and group shows that may have artists that aren't on the roster, for example.
Very interesting. So how are we doing in relation to the rest of the country? Is it pretty much the same?
The rest of the country shows, the New York report card looked at 34 leading galleries. It found that only two of them clocked in with equal time for women. So that was a very dispiriting number.
Very interesting. So there is this kind of illusion, and we see, I think, a similar thing going on in race relations, that we've made some changes in this country. And in fact, probably legally, we have made some changes in this country, but it's not illegal to show fewer women than men in your gallery. And so in so many ways where perhaps unconscious bias or whatever are coming into play, we aren't improving at a very rapid pace. What's going on?
Well, I do think unconscious bias has something to do with it. We tend to associate art made by men with art that brings higher prices at auctions. We tend to associate prestigious museums as museums that are being run by men. There's many, many places where we can see this association between high success for men in the visual arts and lesser success for women. But I think, you know, if we go back, let's say, to the 1980s, when feminist artists really began to flex their muscle, when women's history programs started in universities, I think a lot of people hoped that those kinds of projects would become unnecessary. Because once women artists made their names, once women artists got in museums, once critics started writing about them, women artists would just be an integral part of the whole story. But as we've just heard from these statistics, that hasn't happened.
And I think one of the things we see in unconscious bias is that it's not only that we're biased against others, we can even be biased against ourselves. And so the internalization of biases is something that's very hard to counter when one of the things that also happens is that it's unconscious. You're not aware that you have it.
Yeah. And I think many of us have those things. And even when we do become aware of them, I mean, let's say somebody was a gallery owner and they understood that this particular artist who comes in is fetching higher prices, and they want to show them because of that, and then it becomes a business decision, and those kinds of things perpetuate themselves.
Yeah, we have to talk about money when we have this conversation. Gallerists want to sell, to show art that will sell. Collectors actually find that it's prestigious to be able to buy more expensive art. There's just a kind of vicious circle here, and I think what we really need to do is expand the body of work that people are thinking about, looking at, valorizing, and bring women into the fold. And it's not a kind of change that can start in one place. It's a change that has to come from every interest group that's involved here. The artists, the gallerists, the critics, the museum directors and curators, the collectors, the philanthropists. Everybody needs to buy into change.
There is a question that comes up in my mind when you talk about feminist art of the 80s, which I remember being around in the 80s and witnessing all of this stuff and going kind of obsessively to galleries and museums and art spaces and performance art and all that kind of thing. And I think for a lot of people, and especially young people who were trying to be part of that creative change at the time, and young people are trying to do that now, that art is really popular. But for somebody who is bringing an object home to put in their house and live with for the rest of their life, maybe feminist art isn't really as saleable.
Well, there's a huge trend today to social practice art. We're seeing a big focus on that at Santa Fe Art Institute, for example. Some of the artists in previous sites, Santa Fe Biennials and other shows, have been invested in that. It's interesting that I think there's also a movement towards performance-based art that's temporal, that's time-limited. And yeah, these are things that you can't take home except as experiences, and maybe they contribute to changing definitions of what success in the arts. How do you measure that? Is it purely a dollar and cent proposition?
I know that part of the conversation that you're going to have at this event, which is called How to Be a Successful Woman Artist, is as much a process of eliciting feedback and conversation from the participants as it is you guys talking about your own views on this. I mean, I think it's going to be a wonderful event. So I don't want to go too far into this, but I mean, it does raise the question of how an artist defines success, particularly given that we live in a world where the mythologies that we grew up with were things like, you know, Vincent van Gogh, who innovated and didn't succeed at all in any financial sense and didn't sell at all, but is remembered when all of his other successful contemporaries of the time, or most of them, are forgotten. So that question of success is an interesting one.
Well, we're going to talk about success, but everybody's going to be talking about success. This is not a lecture program. It's not a conventional panel program. We're going to have a series of roundtables where everybody's talking and arguing and fighting. And so it's not
really fighting.
I hope there will be some constructive fighting. So it's not just artists, including some high school artists that we've invited to the program, talking about their definition of success. We're going to have gallery owners there talking. We're going to have collectors there talking. And I think it'll be very interesting and I hope productive to see where different people's ideas of success do and don't support one another.
You, Marnie, as a historian, have some tools that the rest of us don't have when we think about how social change happens. And you've looked at a lot of issues, including race. How do you see, like, what are the factors that go into genuine social change?
Oh, that's a very tough question. Genuine social change is slow. And I think it often has to bring together change that happens at a grassroots level with people really changing their attitudes and committing to live their lives in a different way. But lots of social change can't also happen without support from the top, whether it's people passing different laws or, in this case, museums and curators and gallery owners deciding to operate their businesses and their institutions in different ways.
Well, I think one of the things we're really hoping happens Wednesday night of the 5th is that most of the time when some of these entities speak to one another, they're doing so because of the expectations that people have when they come together. An artist inviting a gallerist to make a studio visit, a gallerist hosting an art opening where collectors come and there's a hope of making a sale. And so here's a conversation where the only thing on the table at the front of the night is that everybody be really committed to speaking candidly and sharing their experiences. And that's where I think Marnie and I and the other organizers believe that some constructive arguing may come in, because when that really happens, it's going to reveal what some of the schism lines are between these silos in the art world.
And I hope we can have some productive conversations around a few key points. One would be, I feel like people need to trust themselves. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that if you're a collector and you're interested in adding to your collection, you don't read just what the New York Times says about that particular artist, or you don't rely solely on the value of a particular curator. You go out and you look at the work and you trust your gut and you say, I value this work and I don't need someone else to tell me how to respond to it. For a young artist, it might mean, a young girl saying, I know I want to be a sculptor and I need to learn welding. And you have to trust that that's the right thing, and you have to advocate for yourself. So these changes, these are the sorts of grassroots changes that I think I was talking about earlier.
I think it's interesting when you talk about collecting. I mean, the people who have really genuinely great collections that are then given to museums and so on often are people who really do trust their guts, people who have a great eye, people who go against the grain, people who collect artists that nobody's ever heard of, people who get to know those artists and visit their studios, people who even support those artists over the years where they are unknown. And I've witnessed this. I knew a guy like that, and he was a complete outcast in the art world, but by the time he died, he had a massive collection full of, you know, Georgia O'Keeffe and John Marin paintings and stuff like that. And he just knew what he was doing without over-reliance on critics. And that does, you know, it does call up the question of that interesting relationship between critics and collectors and artists.
Well, it was, I mean, it's just a funny story that when Sotheby's was an auction house called Park Bernay in 1968, the famous tale was that the artist Bob Rauschenberg punched the taxi mogul Robert Scull in the stomach because Scull had traded up an artwork that he'd bought for a really small amount of money. Now, to your point about collectors building their collection based in passion for certain art and an eye, there's been this encroachment of incredible amounts of capital into the art world. Every time there's an auction season, the numbers change to hundreds of millions of dollars, even billions of dollars traded back and forth. And that, in a way, is having a dampening effect on the ability of many artists to get their work and their names out there, because many collectors are chasing capital and chasing the idea of a value in the art world that comes from this kind of quick turn that's very antithetical to the long-term values of art.
Yeah, I mean, the people who can afford a, you know, $20 million single work of art, I mean, that's monopoly money to most of us. And the fact that the world has gotten to the point where so few people have so much money and the rest of us are kind of struggling for the breadcrumbs left over when they've finished eating. I mean, when you talk about arts of social change, which is part of this whole program, I mean, that's part of the social change that people want to change in the first place, is the money that these rich collectors have that is so far out of proportion and so far beyond what any human being really needs.
I think the recession has created some interesting new phenomena, though, which is these makers movements. We're seeing that here in Santa Fe. And so artists can increasingly, I think of themselves in a number of ways. And there are new mechanisms for selling and getting the word out about one's work. The digital revolution has made it possible to build followings where maybe in the past you really did have to be dependent on a gallery, a collector, established systems of representation, and now you don't.
Say more about that. What are some of these new mechanisms for getting one's work out?
Well, there are some online platforms of collective galleries. There's in Santa Fe, Santa Fe Collective is a good example, run by artist Jennifer Joseph and Chris Collins, to be a venue that's somewhere between a gallery, an exhibition space, a performance space, and a store. And I think we're seeing more of that, because whether it's that a group of artists who might have gone to art school together get together and they say, hey, we're all working in the same vein, let's build a website and put our works on it. Or people are opting to exhibit themselves on existing online platforms. Or it takes work. It's that it always takes work to find an audience for your work.
Ellen Berkovich, you have an online publication called AdobeAirstream.com. Now, do you monitor yourself for gender equity?
You know, I do somewhat, because I publish virtual artist projects, and I tend to overpublish women artist projects and artists without gallery representation. They're not for sale. It's not a monetization strategy. It's just a way to get in front of my readership and viewership. Solid essay, photo essay based, or they're not always photographs, but images of a body of work that coheres. And I've just been looking back before coming on your show and saw I've overrepresented women. So I don't know whether that was conscious or unconscious bias. So that's something I'm happy about.
Very interesting. We talked a couple of weeks ago with neuroscientist Jennifer Raymond, who was talking exactly about the subject of unconscious bias. And one of the interesting examples in bias or getting beyond bias happened in music and symphony orchestras auditioning musicians behind a screen so that the listeners couldn't tell whether it was a man or a woman, and that led to a vast increase in the number of women in the orchestra. Is something like that possible in the arts? Like if you had gallery shows where everybody was using their, both men and women, using their initials? I mean, what do you think?
Well, I've been thinking about that, and I'm not sure it can work, especially when we're talking about art that attempts to affect social change. I think viewers of that kind of art deeply care who created the work. What is their experience? What kind of knowledge do they bring to that particular work of art? Where are they coming from? And I think to take that away, to take that biographical component out of the art, has the potential of making it less effective and powerful. So that makes the dilemma we're addressing here all the tougher. I think we really just have to be mindful. We have to be asking ourselves, are we giving everybody a fair shake when we look at the work? Are we looking as broadly as we can look? Are we trusting ourselves? Are we discovering new people? Do we have the faith that we can make judgments that a critic might not have made, or a curator, or a museum director? We need to expand the range of women who are represented in the world of visual arts, and we need to start doing that now, and we hope we can do that at our conversation on August 5th.
And the conversation is called How to Be a Successful Woman Artist. It's on Wednesday, the 5th of August at 7 in the evening at the Munoz Waxman Gallery at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe on Old Pecos Trail, sponsored by the Women's International Study Center. Both this event and the event with Susan Fisher Sterling that we talked about in the first part of the show require tickets, and you can get those at brownpapertickets.com. Marnie Sandweiss is professor of history at Princeton University. Ellen Berkovich is publisher and editor-in-chief of AdobeAirstream.com. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.